The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. On three fronts, the Middle East is aflame, and on the same three fronts, a perilous web of diplomacy attempts to minimize the civilian cost. A pause, we learned today, in the fighting in Iraq to retake the city of Mosul from ISIS, an offensive which tests more than a decade of policies trying to build an Iraq that can go it alone. It also threatens 1.2 million civilians hoping to be free of ISIS's rule. The catastrophe in Aleppo, Syria, is unabated, even as Russia and the U.S. and others attempt to try yet another ceasefire agreement. The situation in war-torn and poverty-stricken Yemen has reached a level of urgency where a 72-hour ceasefire has been declared by the United Nations. The news came after the release of American hostages over the weekend and an exchange of missile fire late last week between American forces and Houthi rebels, marking the very first time the United States has directly attacked the rebels in Yemen's 20-month civil war. Here's Secretary of State John Kerry.
But we cannot emphasize enough today the urgency of ending the violence of Yemen, of providing for an opportunity for a political settlement, which is the only way it will be ultimately resolved.
The United Nations has reported that more than 10,000 people have been killed since the start of the fighting, and more than half of the population of Yemen does not have enough food. The U.S. is nominally part of the coalition with Saudi Arabia that has created these famine conditions. Is the U.S. on the side of catastrophe? Christine Beckerle is a Yemen and Kuwait researcher for the Middle East and North Africa Division of Human Rights Watch. She joins me now from Amman, Jordan, and says that's a profoundly difficult question to answer.
I would say that the conflict in Yemen is quite complicated because it's really not just what we've been seeing since March 26, 2015, when the Saudi-led coalition that you mentioned began its aerial campaign in Yemen, but it's really a lot of local grievances that have been going on for a very long time that have festered into a real serious armed conflict in Yemen right now. That being said, what we can say at this point is that you have the Saudi-led coalition, which has been carrying out an aerial campaign against the Houthis and their allies, including forces loyal to former President Ali Abdullah Saleh, since March 26, 2015. And that aerial campaign itself has truly been devastating for Yemen. And that's the side on which the U.S. has been involved and providing weapons to since for over a year and a half now.
Is it the case that the U.S. opposes Iran in this Yemen situation? The Houthis are perceived to be proxies of Iran, which would put the U.S. both on the side of Iran and against Iran in various conflicts. That also complicates matters.
I think a lot of people have taken to describing it as a proxy war, but I think that's actually a misrepresentation as far as we know of what's going on, because the Houthis and their allies, including, like I said, forces loyal to former President Ali Abdullah Saleh, these are really local Yemeni groups that have been present in the Yemeni political landscape for a very long time and have their own sort of domestic grievances that have led us to where we are today. So to describe it as a proxy war, a sectarian war, I think is really to obfuscate what is actually going on in Yemen right now.
Let's talk about the humanitarian situation. Yemen, of course, is one of the poorest nations in the world. How has this fighting complicated the ability of getting aid to civilians?
It's very hard to describe in words how terrible the humanitarian situation in Yemen is right now. It was already quite bad before March 26, 2015, when the Saudi-led aerial campaign began. But now it's really at crisis levels.
For outsiders looking at the Middle East, you've got three serious situations. I'm wondering if you could evaluate them for us as someone who's an observer of the region. You've got the invasion of Mosul, the attempt to retake it from ISIS, and the humanitarian potential for disaster there with 1.2 million civilians in Mosul. You've got the situation in Aleppo, which has gone on now for so long between opposition forces to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, and then the Yemeni situation you've just described. Are all the three of these of the equal significance, or is one more important than the other?
I wouldn't say that one is more important than the other. What I would say is that you're looking across the region at a number of, again, not to mince words, but really humanitarian catastrophes. And that what I would hope is that you're looking at a bunch of situations where laws of war violations have really continued on with impunity. And what I would hope is that looking at that and looking at what we've been seeing over the last, you know, a couple of years now, that the powers that be would be taking seriously the fact that this cannot be allowed to continue in the way in which it has. If we do care about international law and we do care about civilian protection, because not only in Yemen, but in Syria and Iraq, you're really looking at situations where these things have been allowed to continue for a long time, and that cost is becoming sort of incalculable.
Christine Beckerle is a Yemen and Kuwaiti researcher for the Middle East and North Africa Division of Human Rights Watch. She spoke to me from Amman, Jordan. Christine, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Let's get some perspective now from Barbara Bodine, who was U.S. ambassador to Yemen from 1997 to 2001. She is currently director of the Institute for the Study of Diplomacy at Georgetown University. Welcome, Ambassador.
Thank you.
How are we to sort out whose side the United States is on in Yemen, if there is a side that can be declared clearly for the U.S. to be on?
That is not as simple, straightforward a question as it may sound. I suppose we are on the side of a legitimate government in Yemen, and that has been our goal since the beginning. It is the goal of the U.N. Security Council, which passed a resolution about 18 months ago to restore the legitimate government, and it is the stated goal of the coalition. I think where it becomes a bit more murky is a question of how do you get to the restoration or the establishment of, because those are not the same, of a legitimate government in Yemen.
Has the coalition behaved in a way that you would describe as militarily appropriate? Human Rights Watch declared that the coalition was involved in the bombing of a funeral service and that that would include possible United States involvement.
Not only did Human Rights Watch declare that the coalition was responsible for the bombing of a funeral hall, and we're talking about over 140 dead and several hundred wounded, the Saudis have taken responsibility for that. They said that it was an error in intelligence. The United States has been actively supporting this military campaign since the beginning. We provide assistance at headquarters. The U.S. Air Force flies refueling on behalf of the Saudi Air Force. And so we have been very actively involved in this campaign.
How would you say the attempt to release hostages, which the U.S. did successfully over the weekend, and also its own what were described as appropriate airstrikes by the White House, operations that are different from or the same as the coalition operations in Yemen?
Well, we were able to secure the release of a number of our citizens, hostages, and I think credit needs to go to the Omani government for having made those arrangements. The cruise missile strike that you mentioned was described by the U.S. Navy as a narrow act of self-defense, and I think what they were signaling with that is that they would certainly take action against the Houthi, who are the rebels or the insurgents, if they did fire on U.S. Navy ships. But I think by describing it as a narrow act, they were also signaling that we really have no desire or intention, unless significantly provoked, to get directly militarily involved in this.
And you would describe it as a catastrophe, as others in the region have?
Absolutely. What Yemen is facing at this point, I think, can best be described as an imposed famine. This is not due to climate. This is not due to just the kind of usual governmental mismanagement. In the course of this campaign, the port facilities have been damaged, the roads, the bridges, the airports have been closed, and a country that was, in the best of times, dependent on food imports, medicine, water, and fuel, has been essentially under siege. there is no medicine coming in. There is no food. I think it's over 100 medical facilities have been destroyed. The water treatment plants have been destroyed. The power grid has been destroyed. So this was a country that was already the poorest country in the Middle East, and its infrastructure no longer exists, and nothing is coming in. That is a catastrophe.
Ambassador Bodin, forgive me if I'm missing something here, but you've described a set of situations where the U.S. has allowed itself to be part of a coalition that has produced an imposed famine in one of the poorest nations in the world, a place the U.S. would normally be supplying aid to, and at the same time, we maintain our own ability to take potshots at al-Qaeda in eastern Yemen. How could the United States have gotten involved in such a human rights disaster?
Well, that's not a question. I'm not a party to the policy deliberations in the U.S. government any longer. I do think that I assume that at least in the beginning, in March of 2015, there was a belief that with limited airstrikes, limited military involvement on the part of the Saudis and their Arab coalition partners, that the legitimate government, the Hadi government, could be returned to power, and the insurgents, the Houthis, who at that time had already swept as far south as Aden, would be dislodged. And I think what has happened is that this has just continued to grind on in a way that people did not fully anticipate. And as I said, I think it is important to note that we have been working at the same time with the Saudis, with others, with the British, to come up with a cessation in hostilities so that the humanitarian crisis can be addressed. And we were the U.S. government, we're very actively involved in trying to get the peace talks, which ran from about April until August. And we're still trying to do that. But you are quite right, there is a bit of a disconnect between what we are trying to do diplomatically, what we want to do on the humanitarian side, and our continued involvement and support for the Saudi campaign. There is a disconnect.
What do you make of the 72-hour ceasefire announced by the UN?
I think 72 hours is better than nothing, but it's not going to address the humanitarian problem. As I said, the ports have been knocked out, the roads are knocked out. So even if you had a 72-hour cessation, you don't have time to get food into the ports. You don't have the ability to get them into the major population areas, which are all inland. They're not coastal cities. You would also have to be able to fly in medicine. So 72 hours is a good start, but it's not really going to do very much.
I can certainly hear the frustration in your voice, Ambassador. Barbara Bodin was U.S. Ambassador to Yemen from 1997 to 2001. She's currently director of the Institute for the Study of Diplomacy at Georgetown University. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
The business model for American universities has been facing serious competition with rising tuition prices and multiplying options beyond the traditional four-year residential institution. Also, because the U.S. student population eligible for college study with financial aid represents a huge market, foreign educational institutions have been trying to set up shop in the U.S. and get a piece of that market. The India-based Amity University enrolls 125,000 students at over a dozen campuses around the world and now has its sights set on New York and Massachusetts. Last month, the college chain bought a campus on Long Island, although they're still waiting for permission to operate a college there. Amity also wants to purchase two more U.S. campuses, including a troubled for-profit college near Boston that's scheduled to close, the New England Institute of Art. Does Amity plan to join the list of predatory for-profit universities, or does it want to try and do a better job? State officials in Massachusetts, including Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey, want more information about Amity before they grant any licenses.
We've had experience in our office pursuing any number of for-profit schools that have been out there, really raking it in on the backs of vulnerable students. And we had a school here that we'd been investigating announced last year that it was going to wind down its operations. Amity is the entity that's proposed to come in and take over the operation of this school. And we have real concerns about that. Amity is not licensed. It has no experience providing this kind of education. This is an arts curriculum and a photography curriculum to students in Massachusetts or anywhere else in the country. And it's really important to me that students actually have an opportunity to have real courses taught by real teachers, real in-studio time. As you can imagine, this is really important to the kind of curriculum that they're studying. And that it be real. And unfortunately, I don't see that Amity has the kind of track record here in the States to provide that kind of programming to students who've already been duped once.
All right. One way of evaluating Amity is that it has 125,000 students enrolled at more than a dozen campuses around the world. We've had difficulty reaching directly officials at Amity, but one quoted at the Associated Press says, and this is the chancellor, Asim Chauhan, says, "We continuously benchmark our quality with the best quality standards and the best accreditation standards globally. Does that put your mind at rest? And particularly given that the workforce of India is among the most productive in the world."
Well, I think that we should be benchmarking against what our standards are. And particularly here in Massachusetts, we have high standards. And it's really important to us as a state that we remain a leader when it comes to higher education. And one of the things that concerns me is that there isn't enough real transparency. There isn't enough real data out there. And certainly we've seen with some of these companies that they come in and they're wonderful at talking the talk, but down the road, you see escalating default rates, low graduation rates, high debt. And here, my concern is we have a school, NEIA, that we believe has hurt students. If they want Amity to come in and take over that operation, we've got a real concern about that, given Amity's lack of track record with students here in Massachusetts or students here in the United States with respect to this particular arts curriculum.
Would you recommend that Amity not be granted a license based on the information you have and the statements that you've seen from the company?
At this point, absolutely. That is our position. This needs to go before the Board of Higher Education. The Board of Higher Education needs to demand answers, needs to receive answers, and needs to make sure that students are going to be protected, that education is going to be real, that courses are going to be real, because we've got a number of students who are stuck right now, who were the victims of a for-profit predatory school that announced a wind down a year ago. And before we have them continue on with their education overseen by Amity, we need to make sure that's going to be real or else they go to somewhere else.
But how would you answer the charge that you're applying a kind of Logan Airport limousine metaphor here in that Amity is flooding Massachusetts with unqualified or less than high-quality teachers in the same way that people have a perception that people from South Asia suddenly flooded the limousine services of the United States, and that somehow, because this is an Indian company, it's suspect, and that you would not treat a Swedish or a British or French company trying to do the same thing in the same way.
Well, that's certainly not what we've done here. This has nothing to do with where this company originates from. My standard would be the same, whether it's with respect to a Boston-based company or a company based in the U.S. or a company based anywhere else in the world. Standards are standards, and we want to make sure it's real.
Finally, do you have any concerns or information that Amity and companies like it are essentially getting into the U.S. market because of favorability on the granting of visas, H-1B visas, et cetera?
I can't speak to that directly. My concerns are about Amity's track record. Amity was founded by an individual who was charged with fraud many, many years ago. I have concerns about what we've actually seen in terms of real-life practice here at a campus in Massachusetts. And we need to have answers, and we need to make sure that things are being done in a way that will truly benefit students. We can't have students being used simply as a mechanism by which some of these for-profit companies get their hands on loan money, federal loan money that we taxpayers pay for, and use that as a conduit to line the pockets of their investors at the expense of students. There's nothing wrong with making money, but you can't make money on the backs of vulnerable students and provide them no real education in return. That's not what these students were promised. That's not what they signed up for. It's my job as Attorney General to make sure that companies are held to the promises they make.
Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey, thank you so much.
Great to be with you, John.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
What do the parents of Spanish-speaking children in California want for their kids? And are they likely to get it by going to the polls in November? Proposition 58 will allow students for the first time in 18 years to take bilingual language classes without signed consent from parents. Less than 5% of California public schools now offer such programs. That's down significantly from 1998, when another ballot measure, Prop 227, started requiring that parental consent for instruction in languages other than English be obtained. The sponsor of Prop 58, Senator Ricardo Lara, says multilingual programs are needed, but our next guest, activist Ron Unz, was behind Prop 227 and says it's unlikely that this ballot measure will significantly change things for students.
Prop 227, which we passed 18 years ago, allows parents of immigrant students to place their children in a non-English class if they sign an annual written waiver. But the problem many of these bilingual activists have run into is that since most immigrant parents prefer English, it's hard to persuade them to sign the waiver. And for that reason, there's a limit on the number of these classes, which requires the presence of Spanish-speaking students. So Prop 58 eliminates the waiver requirement and allows immigrant students to be placed in these Spanish classes, even if their parents don't sign a written waiver. And the motivation is coming entirely from the English-speaking parents who want to ensure that their children can learn Spanish. And it's easier for them to learn Spanish if there are lots of Spanish-speaking students in the same class with them. So that's really what the driving force is.
State Senator Ricardo Lara says that multilingual and dual immersion programs are actually critical to help students compete in an increasingly global and multilingual workforce. Do you go along with that?
Well, I mean, I think they're certainly beneficial in many cases. In other words, it's certainly useful for children to learn another language when they're young and it's easy for them to do that. But if we're talking about immigrant families whose children don't know English, I think it's most important for them to learn English. And if you take a child from a family, for example, where everybody at home speaks Spanish, they watch Spanish TV, they listen to Spanish radio, the people in their neighborhood speak Spanish, and if you put them to a class in which almost all the instruction is in Spanish, they'll have a very hard time learning English. And that's why the parents under the current system are quite reluctant to sign the waivers if they're offered an English class instead, and they really prefer English rather than the Spanish almost only classes.
So what do you do on election day? Do you, as a parent, I mean, who has an easy decision here on Prop 58?
Well, to be honest, there's 17 initiatives on the ballot, and Prop 58 has gotten relatively little attention. Also, the advocates of Prop 58, the sponsors, gave it the title English Language Education Initiative, even though it actually repeals the requirement for an English language education. So I think probably a lot of voters may vote for it because they support an English language education. In practical terms, I think there's probably a pretty good chance it'll pass just because with 17 initiatives, nobody really knows what's going on. But on the other hand, I think it's extremely unlikely that there will be any major changes in statewide educational policy. In other words, certainly the number of students in these Spanish almost only so-called bilingual programs will increase, but it'll probably increase to like 1% or 2%, where 20 years ago it was 70%, and that really was a disaster at the time.
Ron Unz is chairman of English for the Children, an organization that sponsored Proposition 227 back in 1998. Thanks so much, Ron.
Thank you.
Alas, the fate of New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, once the shining star of the Republican Party amidst the Mitt Romney defeat in 2012. He's lately been serving Republican nominee Donald Trump as chairman of his transition team. But he lurks in the shadow of the big political scandal in his home state. The Bridgegate trial, taking place in Newark, New Jersey, is a story of political revenge and a very nasty traffic jam for commuters trying to get across the George Washington Bridge. Two major witnesses testifying this week may talk about what Christie knew and whether or not he covered it up. Matt Katz, reporter for WNYC and author of American Governor, Chris Christie's Bridge to Redemption, joins me now. Matt, welcome.
Thank you, John.
So where does this stand right now, up to the minute?
Up to the minute, we're halfway through this Bridgegate trial, and Chris Christie's reputation is taking a beating from both the prosecution side and the defense side. His former appointees who are charged in this scheme are alleging that they were just basically following orders, that this was determined at a higher pay grade than they were at to close these lanes to the George Washington Bridge, to cause this traffic jam, to punish a local mayor for not endorsing him. And the prosecution, the feds are saying this was part of a pattern in the administration, that the administration had a pattern of seeking revenge against politicians, local mayors who didn't support or endorse the governor.
Are the feds going after Christie himself or just officials in the administration?
The feds' key witness is a former Christie appointee who has pleaded guilty, and that witness has gone after Christie pretty hard. So yes, the feds are going after him, but only reputationally. They don't appear to be ready to file any charges whatsoever, but it fits within their case to have their witness allege that Chris Christie knew about this whole scheme while it was happening. They've alleged that.
What about the gold, or I guess we could call it lead parachute, of being a part of the Donald Trump transition team? Is that still solid at this point?
It's been a little bit rocky,
yeah,
but Chris Christie is standing by his man. The morning after that big Access Hollywood tape where Trump was bragging about sexual assault, Christie went into New York City. He crossed the river. I don't know if he took the bridge, probably took the tunnel, but came from New Jersey into New York and went to Trump Tower and met with Trump and was dealing with the damage control over that. He has taken a little bit of a lower profile role in the campaign over the last week and a half, but he's still involved in this transition team, going to Northern Virginia regularly to have meetings about what a Trump administration may look like, identifying potential cabinet members. So he's still very much involved.
Any sign that Trump may want to distance himself from Christie based on all of what's going on in Newark?
There has been no sign of that, even though during the early presidential campaign, when Christie was still an opponent of Trump, Trump had said that Christie totally knew about the bridge scheme. Trump has since said that he totally believes Chris Christie, and Trump doesn't really have much of a history of, you know, getting rid of people who might not be, you know, all up on the law necessarily. He doesn't really discard people for that kind of thing.
Indeed. So what is the reputation of Chris Christie going forward? I mean, he's term limited in New Jersey. As a politician, I mean, this is a Shakespearean story in a sense.
Sure. December 2013, he was leading all polls to be the 2016 Republican nominee. A month later, Bridgegate scandal happens and his career collapsed in very rapid form. And I don't know what happens for him from going forward, but I think he believes that there's a chance for resurrection, that 2020, if Trump were to lose, is definitely a possibility for him still in his mind running for president again.
So he wants to have elective office, the idea of being a lobbyist or going, you know, to Rutgers University and being some sort of professor doesn't interest him at all.
I think he wants to be in the conversation. And if that means elected office or if that means attorney general or chief of staff in a Trump administration, he'll take any of those jobs.
Well, if he wants to stay in the conversation, it sounds like you've got another book that you might have to do.
That's right. He might not like that book very much, though.
Yes. Reporter for WNYC and author of American Governor, Chris Christie's Bridge to Redemption, on the up-to-the-minute status of Governor Chris Christie and his relationship to Donald Trump in the midst of this homegrown scandal called Bridgegate. Thanks so much, Matt.
Thank you, John.
Way back in 2003, the Bush administration passed the program Medicare Part D to control the cost of prescription drugs for seniors who were paying out of their own pockets back then. Almost immediately, Part D was seen to be a potentially huge drain on the U.S. Treasury, and now certain chronic medications are breaking the bank for seniors for whom Medicare Part D covers only part of the out-of-pocket costs for drugs. This issue has made it into the 2016 campaign, but neither campaign has been able to clearly lay out what the problem is. An investigation by the news organization Fair Warning into Medicare Part D may help here. It says price spikes may be due to an overwhelming influence by drug industry lobbyists and a law that seems to tie the hands of insurance providers. Stuart Silverstein is assistant editor for Fair Warning, a nonprofit investigative news organization based in Pasadena, California. It focuses on public health, safety, and environmental issues. He carried out this investigation. Stuart, welcome, and thanks for trying to clear out something that's anything but clear.
Well, sure. Thanks for having me on.
First of all, seniors pay part of the cost of drugs under Medicare Part D. What has escalated in the last few years, and what is the reason for that escalation as far as you can tell?
There's price increases throughout the the healthcare economy, of course. One of the points we dug into, though, is why have drug prices risen so much under this program? This program, which is aimed at helping 43 million seniors this year, versus other federal healthcare programs. And we found things like, well, according to one report, the government pays 80% more for prescription drugs under this program than it does through the veterans program. It pays 73% more for drugs under this program than it does through Medicaid. So there's a huge gap here. Now, they got lucky for a while with the rise of generic drugs in recent years. That generally, moderated cost increases in prescription drugs. But that trend's now changing, so the real concern is going forward. Are these prices really going to explode, and what can be done to stop that?
Well, you've alluded to the issue that's really basic to this whole thing. I mean, if you're talking about chronic drug medications that people take on a daily basis for a period of years, where these aren't curative medications, these are things that you would expect the price over time to go down as you move into generics and just basically the economies of scale. Why is the opposite happening here?
Well, first of all, new medications are being developed over the course of our lifetimes. Of course, we develop new health conditions. So sometimes on the individual level, if that's what you're pointing to, the mix of things that we need can change. And as new drugs are introduced, there's often a cost surge. Over time, the patent on those drugs plays out. Generic drugs come in, and that helps moderate prices. One of the problems now is that we're at a point in the cycle where, after benefiting from the rise of generic drugs for so many years, that benefit has played out. New medications are being developed, so we're getting a new price surge. In this case, but let's take a step back. People in this country pay more for prescription drugs than in any other country around
right,
the world.
Right.
And one of the contributors to it is the job or the lack of a job that the federal government does in imposing some kind of restraints on prices.
Now, candidates have talked generically about the idea of better negotiations for drug prices. You've alluded to the fact that the Veterans Administration pays different prices than Medicaid or even Medicare under Part D. What would that look like? Would that be a special agency that sets the price? Would it be a negotiation that seniors would actually sit in on or consumers would actually sit in on? How would that look?
Well, we really already have something for this, something very much like this, that is. For instance, in the veterans program, they decide what drugs are going to be offered. And if there's, say, two drugs that, perform a similar function and one is cost efficient, they can get at a reasonable price, and one is a very high price. They'll take the position that we're going to buy the drug that's sold to us at a reasonable price, and we're not going to use the drug that has similar benefits but is much more costly. So, in fact, on the individual insurance company level, this goes on all the time. We have drug lists called formularies, And so that's used by the Veterans Administration. It's used by individual drug companies. So the structure for this kind of thing is already in place.
But lobbyists have an overwhelming influence?
There's an enormous amount of lobbying done by the drug industry. In fact, the drug industry and the insurance industry are the two, you know, big dogs of lobbying in Washington. And many critics have said that's why nothing ever happens. You know, ever since this law was passed back in 2003, which provided the prescription drug benefit for seniors, there have been efforts to let the government do some price negotiation, just the way it does for, say, the veterans program. But every year those laws go nowhere. And the most plausible explanation is that so much money is spent on lobbying and, to a lesser extent, on campaign donations that none of these bills go anywhere.
And Part D has really enabled the growth of this lobbying business, wouldn't you say, Stuart?
It's a piece of it.
Right, right. Stuart Silverstein is assistant editor for Fair Warning, a nonprofit investigative news organization based in Pasadena, California. Thanks so much, Stuart.
Thank you.
For generations, the idea of escaping from behind the Iron Curtain was the definition of a suicide mission. The Berlin Wall was a prison tower, in fact, and imagination, symbolizing the Cold War.
As the communist barrier between East and West Berlin grows higher and stronger, the more determined grows the will of those in the East to escape. Along the border, East Berliners are forced to evacuate their homes as the communist police move to prevent their escape.
From 1961 to 1989, the Berlin Wall divided not only the city but also a nation. It was the fault line of communism. More than 200 people died trying to get over, around, and under that wall. In West Berlin, before the Russians got wise and closed off the passages forever, building tunnels under the wall offered a frightening and slim chance of escape. For two U.S. television networks, the race to get an unprecedented scoop aided the tunnel effort. In the end, only one network would succeed and make history. It's a little-known story documented by Greg Mitchell, author of The Tunnels, Escapes Under the Berlin Wall and the Historic Films the JFK White House Tried to Kill. That book is out today.
The wall was such a brutal barrier because it overnight separated friends and family. 60,000 East Berliners worked in West Berlin. They lost their jobs. So it was more than just a symbol of something. It extremely impacted lives and made East Berlin seem more like a prison.
And it really divided the city, but there was tremendous pressure to get people out.
Yeah, almost from the beginning, there were people attempting to escape via various methods, from swimming across the canals to trying to walk through old subway tunnels, smashing through the wall in trucks. But the East Germans cracked down on all that. And so by early 1962, which is when my book starts, tunneling under the wall became the favored way to try to bring people out. And what was most amazing is, unlike almost every example in history, these were dug from the West to the East, from freedom to people who were, if you want to say, enslaved. So it was not the people trying to dig out themselves. It was people who were already free, who were risking their lives and arrest to dig into East Berlin.
What's the engineering of a project like this?
In some cases, they just would work week after week in the most difficult way, with just shovels and picks and a cart that they would drag back to the West and slowly make this progress. Sometimes the tunnels were only 70 or 100 feet long. One of the two tunnels that I focus on in my book was 400 feet. It started in the basement of a factory in West Berlin, go under the wall, and then under the death strip, which had the border guards, had snipers, dogs, two blocks under there, and came out in the basement of a tenement two blocks further. So this was a massive project. Now, larger tunnels like that, they actually put up wood supports around the side. So it looked somewhat professional, but in many other cases, it was just a hole in the ground.
For a tunnel of that size, I mean, who had to be behind it?
In general, young West Berlin students who are healthy and motivated. But as I show in the book, the two U.S. TV networks funded them in whole or in part, and gave them that kind of support.
And what was the competition between the networks that affected the outcomes of people who use those tunnels?
This was the golden age of the TV documentary. It's hard to believe today, but every week there were primetime specials on the three networks. Now, at that time, CBS and NBC were in a dogfight for ratings. So they were very interested in any kind of scoop or spectacular story like this. And so they were basically CBS with Daniel Shore, a legend in TV and radio, and NBC were in a race to be the first to cover from the inside one of these incredible escape tunnels.
Did you find any evidence that Daniel Shore, a voice who's well known to public radio audiences for his career after CBS, that he had any misgivings about the sort of spectacle of all of this?
As anyone who knew Dan might say, this was his cup of tea.
Yeah.
He was a very contentious, controversial at times figure. And he actually, when his tunnel in August 1962 was basically shut down by the Kennedy administration, he was angry about it the rest of his life. He never really got over it in a way. He felt this would have been one of the great achievements of his life, and it was taken from him for no good reason.
And his vision was bringing families out and having them reunited, you know, in front of the cameras live on network television.
Well, his vision was to cover it, as you say, people escaping. And this is what NBC was able to pull off. When the NBC tunnel, which was not stopped by the Kennedy administration because they did not know about it, when their escape did happen successfully, they did have the cameras there. And they filmed 29 people basically climbing up out of the hole into freedom in West Berlin, an incredibly dramatic footage that later became a landmark television program.
Less than 3 feet wide and 3 feet high. Through this, they crawled, 21 adults and 5 children, 140 yards to West Berlin and a free future. I am Pierce Anderton, NBC News, Berlin.
What was the sense of success? I mean, in other words, you use a tunnel like this once, the East Germans are going to say, all right, we're done with that.
Basically, the final escapes for NBC ended after 2 days because the tunnel was flooded. So that was the end of that. But it was still judged a tremendous success.
Any of the tunnelers still alive?
Yeah, one of the amazing thing I found in this book was almost everyone I wanted to talk to who were intimately involved in these two tunnels. These were even people who broke into the East, you know, literally climbed up into a hole into East Berlin, risked incredible, mind-boggling risks they took, were still alive. And they were in or near Berlin, and they were willing to talk, some of them, for the first time. So the book is based on sort of extensive interviews with all the key participants. It's based on recently declassified documents from the State Department and the White House. It's based on thousands of pages of documents from the Stasi secret police archives in Berlin. So just thousands of pages of sort of exclusive documents and interviews. So I think it's a good combination of real history but also just a sort of an amazing story.
The book is called The Tunnels, Escapes Under the Berlin Wall and the Historic Films the JFK White House Tried to Kill. Greg Mitchell is the author. Thanks so much.
Oh, happy to be here. Thank you.
The Tunnels is out in bookstores today. For an excerpt and photos you can see, visit our website at thetakeaway.org. And here's something to take with you today. There is no answer so far to the Nobel Prize for Literature Committee, who have awarded the Nobel Prize, to songwriter and author Bob Dylan this week, a gesture which Canadian author and fellow winner Margaret Atwood has described as an ode to America in her hour of need. I love that. Dylan may have heard about the prize in the news media or from friends, but he so far hasn't picked up any phone. The Nobel laureate is, shall we say, tangled up in blue until further notice. Subscribe and download to the Takeaway podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. And while you're there, give us a rating. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Storm clouds are raging all around my door. I think to myself I might not take it anymore. Take a woman like your kind to find.
just to know that you are near.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.